The sermon text is our epistle reading for today from 2 Corinthians chapters 5 and 6. We implore you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. For our sake, he made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. Working together with him, then, we appeal to you not to receive the grace of God in vain. For he says, in a favorable time I listened to you, and in a day of salvation I have helped you. Behold, now is the favorable time. Behold, now is the day of salvation. We put no obstacle in anyone's way, so that no fault may be found with our ministry. But as servants of God, we commend ourselves in every way, by great endurance, in afflictions, hardships, calamities, beatings, imprisonments, riots, labors, sleepless nights, hunger, by purity, knowledge, patience, kindness, the Holy Spirit, genuine love, by truthful speech and the power of God, with the weapons of righteousness for the right hand and for the left, through honor and dishonor, through slander and praise, we are treated as impostors and yet are true, as unknown and yet well known, as dying, and behold, we live, as punished and yet not killed, as sorrowful yet always rejoicing, as poor yet making many rich, as having nothing yet possessing everything. This is our text, especially the final phrase, as sorrowful yet always rejoicing. And so it begins. And so suddenly it begins. Just a month ago, it was the festival of Epiphany, and the wreaths and the trees and the treats still declared the joy and the celebration of the lingering Christmas season. But now that's all gone. That's all swallowed up and overwhelmed by the insatiable killjoy called Lent. The overindulged hedonistic debauch called Mardi Gras is over and done. Now it's Wednesday morning. The ashes have arrived. To be honest, though, I'm not too disappointed to see Tuesday in my rearview mirror. I'm not going to miss the supper time pre-recorded phone calls from earnest politicians who sincerely want my support on Super Tuesday. And I'm not going to miss the forced frantic frenzy that transforms Shrove Tuesday into Fat Tuesday, a day infamous for dissolute immorality, with no more excuse than the fact that it's not Lent yet. But of course, if you're staring down the barrel of a 40-day fast, well, I suppose one might be justified in letting loose. Never mind the fact that most of the Mardi Gras revelers will be reveling again this weekend, utterly oblivious to any notion of a Lenten penitence or contrition. But not us. No, we're not sleeping it off this morning. We're here. We're ready for Lent. We're ready for sincere Agnus Deis. We're ready for sorrowful Kyrie eleisons. We're ready for the ashes. Bring it on. You see, for all the negative associations and all the bad reputation that goes with Lent, and particularly its hymnody, I have been struck through the years by the number of people who confide in me how much they love Lent. Now, maybe those are just the melancholy types with a penchant for the morose. Maybe it's that. But I'd like to think that maybe it's something more. I can't help but wonder if people don't embrace Lent with its sober tone and its plaintive tunes because they like having permission to feel sad. You see, after all, we know that our culture is not exactly fond of sadness. To be happy is the goal. It says so in the Declaration of Independence. We all know it. Sadness is antithetical to the American way of life. Sad people are quickly admonished to cheer up, don't bring the mood down, or they're reassured that it's going to get better. We all know that sadness is not the way that it's supposed to be, except during Lent. Starting today, we get 40 days when being sad is not out of style, at least not in the church. For the next 40 days, a person can be sad and get away with it. It's Lent. Sadness has its place. It belongs. In fact, not only is sadness permissible, it's expected. St. Paul says so. Perhaps you missed it. It came right near the end of that long, remarkable rhetorical flourish of phrases and dualities where Paul was describing the life of a minister of the gospel, indeed the life of all who seek to follow Christ. Tucked away in that typically Pauline tumble of words, the apostle declared, "We are sorrowful, but always rejoicing." Or even more woodenly, "as those being sad and always rejoicing." That is, quite simply, a profound and beautiful description of the Christian life. Sad, but always rejoicing. Please understand, Paul is not describing here some sort of hypothetical what about situation. He's not saying, even though we might occasionally be sad in our ministry, we still rejoice. And he is not saying, sometimes it's true we're sad, but even then we know we will rejoice. That's not what he's saying. The two parts are held together in contemporaneous tension. It's one of those similes, both at once. We're sad all the time, but we rejoice all the time. Both, always at the same time. It's a startling thought, because it means that sadness is not an aberration or a temporary annoyance to be alleviated. It means that sadness is not a problem to be solved or fixed. Indeed, it means that sadness is the expectation, the norm of the Christian life. Now, I rather suspect that most Christians do not think this way about being sad. And I suspect that you yourself may be a little reluctant to buy this idea. Sure, we'll recognize that life has its low points. It has periods of sadness. We don't need to be manically happy. But being the optimistic people that we have been taught to be, we count on the sadness to go away, to be replaced by happiness again. And happiness needs to predominate. But that's not how Paul lays it out. Sadness, he contends, is normal. Sadness is the standard. It's the default position. And he's right. And how could it be otherwise for anyone who's honest? We live in a world that is shot through with unbelievable suffering and brokenness and evil. A 15-minute dose of the 10 o'clock news is all the evidence you need. Murder, death, injustice, hatred, disease, corruption, failure. Sin is all around us. Worse, it's all in us. God sets his standard, and you fall short. Always. You're not the student. You're not the friend. You're not the parent, the child, the man or the woman that you know you should be. You're not even the one that you know you could be. You fail God, you fail others, you fail yourself. And on top of all of that, you're dying. Now sure, you can ignore it for a while. For several scores of decades, you can live the illusion of immortality, but it can't last. Inevitably, horribly, it will end. Your life will grind to a bitter final breath. It happens. It happens to others all the time. And it hurts. Oh, it hurts beyond comprehension. But then it's your turn. Remember that you are dust. And to dust you shall return. Sad? Yes, absolutely. Sadness is the descriptor of the Christian life. Cannot be otherwise. And this is pure, unadulterated sadness. It has nothing to do with experiencing a setback or a disappointment or having some sort of injustice happen to you. It's not a matter of being upset or let down or dealing with a bad situation. No, the sadness that describes our lives, the sadness that defines our days, is a chronic, poignant awareness that things are not as they should be. The creation groans and languishes, and I'm to blame. Sadness. People cry. People die. Sadness. This is the sadness that Jesus carried with him. The sadness of knowing the Creator's intended plan and then seeing the reality. And the odd thing is that the better you know the plan, and the better you know the author of the plan, the greater the sadness. Ash Wednesday forces the reality back onto us all. Sadness is the norm. I didn't grow up with ashes on Ash Wednesday. In fact, I'd never seen them until I arrived at my second parish. I was far too pious of a Lutheran to do Roman Catholic ashes. But at my second parish, I was asked on Transfiguration Sunday by a doting altar guild member, "Are you going to do ashes on Wednesday?" I knew the expected answer from the look on her face. I complied, "Yes." And I sorrowed. One of the most sobering exercises of the pastoral ministry has got to be tracing ashen crosses on the foreheads of your parishioners with those awful, tragic words of admonition. Remember, remember that you are dust, and to dust you shall return. Remember, you will die. It's inevitable. It's only a matter of time. You will die. Again and again, trace the cross, speak the sentence. Remember, dust. Remember, dust. Remember, dust. Old wrinkled foreheads, trusting, earnest foreheads of young confirmands, perfect, fresh foreheads of toddlers. Giants in the faith, those on the margins, the same cross, the same terrible sentence. Remember that you are dust, and to dust you shall return. It was surprisingly emotional. It still is. And the emotion is pure, raw sadness. And it's right. And it's good. I once heard an audio recording of a lecture by Richard Wurmbrand, a man who knew something about sadness. With wisdom that exceeded my comprehension at the time, he kept stressing in his lecture the most amazing point. Don't, he insisted, don't mend a broken heart. At the time, I was baffled. I was a seal sorger. I heal people. But he was right. Our hearts must always be broken. Our sadness must remain. You don't flee the sadness. You face it. You embrace it. It is reality. What the Altar Guild ladies failed to tell me on my first real Ash Wednesday is that the previous year's palm ashes are exceedingly messy. They get everywhere, and they leave the blackest tracks. The damp paper towel they so thoughtfully provided couldn't touch the stain on my index finger. It was impervious, even to soap. Ashes are messy business. Sadness is messy business. It permeates everything and stains everything. It can't be helped. Dust stains and sticks. Sadness sticks and stains. But the joy, and the joy also sticks. As those being sad, but always rejoicing. Of course, the rejoicing remains. And this is what makes the Christian utterly unique in this broken, sad world. Christians do not have a corner on sadness. There's plenty of that to go around. But for you and for me, it's all different. You're not like the world's children. You are not trying to find a way to get over the sadness. You're not trying to find a way to make it go away. And you're not swinging back and forth between the poles of sadness and rejoicing, depending on the circumstances. No, you live in sadness always, and you rejoice always. And you do this because you know that it does not end in ashes. It doesn't end under a coating of dust. The ashes cling all through the 40 days of Lent. But at the end, there are no more ashes. There was no dust in the garden tomb. The one who joined us as dust was not reduced to dust. He did not return to the dust. And you who know him and trust him and live in him, you will not remain in the dust either. The Easter ending changes everything. It injects everything with something new, something called hope. Dust-free, ash-cleansed Easter ending fills your days now with something new. It fills them with rejoicing always. Sadness is not the only word. For you, sadness is coupled always with joy, as those being sad, but always rejoicing. That's Lent. That's the Christian life. That's you. Today, it's ashes. Today, you are dust. Today, it's sadness. Don't reject today's reality. Live it. But don't be overwhelmed. You know that the ashes and the dust and the sadness are not always. They're only for a lifetime. The one who is the resolution of every tension, the one who resolves every simile, the one who brings to completion every duality is present even here, even now, even in the ashes, even in the dust, even in the sadness. He's the now. He's the always. Sadness, yes, today while there are still ashes and dust. Rejoicing, yes. Always. Amen.